I hope that we've established certain foundations. Obviously, when we come to Shemos, it's not that many weeks away. It'll be helpful, these foundations, and you know, you have to continue the study. I just wanted to take up a couple of more aspects of the situation that takes place, the encounter between, well, we discussed the encounter between God and Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, and certain aspects, Moshe's reluctance, refusal, so to speak, to assume the position of being the leader of the Jews. Tonight I want to take up, if you'll turn to chapter 7. This is something which is a major area. It's a major problem. The whole method that God used to take the Jews out of Egypt with the 10 plagues, that's a very significant element. Everybody recounts the 10 plagues at the Haggadah. And what's the reason for that? Why did God plan it that way? God could have taken the Jews out immediately, but there's a certain kind of a process there. There's a process of negotiation going on between Moshe and Paro. And you'll notice something ironic. I don't know that I'm going to answer all the questions tonight. I want to leave you with certain things to think about. You'll notice that at points along the way, it seems that Paro is overpowered, and Paro is willing to give in. At a number of points, he says, just get rid of this. Even with the second, the Sephardim. That is the second plague, basically. At that point in time, the houses were filled with the Sephardim, the frogs, and Paro can't take it. And he calls for Moshe and he tells, you know, remove this and I'll let the Jews go. Now you'll see the same pattern being repeated a number of times, and that is that Moshe immediately agrees. He immediately agrees and just asks him whenever you say, and then he prays to God, and God removes the plague, and Paro becomes stubborn again. The whole issue of the stubbornness of Paro, that's a major factor in the story. But I raised the question a couple of years ago. I hadn't seen anybody raise this question. The Torah should be regarded as a scientist would regard the world of nature. That no scientist assumes that all the questions have been asked, that all the information is out there. To the contrary, any genuine scientist knows that we're just beginning. The same is true in the world of Torah. It's infinite wisdom, and as we learn more, and as we of course we build up on the insights of the great rabbi. A person has to know, you know, the methodology. He has to know his place. But there's no such idea that that nobody can come up with a new idea. Anyways, the question that I posed was Moshe a good negotiator? Why did he trust Paro? He seems in a number of places to have trusted him over and over again. The same thing happening. In a number of places, three or four different plagues, when Paro can't take it and his servants are urging him that all of Egypt will be destroyed, so he does give in and he assures Moshe that he'll let him go. And Moshe is always willing. All right, so maybe the first time he trusted him. But after that he should have learned, and shouldn't he have worked it out that to use the leverage properly? That is to say, last time you said the same thing. So let's work it out. You start letting them go, and as you're letting them go, we'll wind it down, so to speak. That's any kind of a situation like hostage exchange. You don't trust. You don't just give the other side what they want and then hope that they'll comply if you have a deal. But Moshe never does that. It was not too humble when it came to the killing of the firstborn. And he warns him in advance. And that there'll be a cry, an outcry, a scream like never was. He gives him warning. He does give him ample warning. But I have a different understanding of humbleness. I don't think that Moshe the way he acted over here was due to his humbleness. You know, Moshe was a warrior. There's no contradiction between the two. He was very confident of what he knew, very confident of himself. Moshe was not lacking in confidence. That's not the real idea. A great person, a great prophet, must have a keen awareness of his own abilities. He has to know. I mean, Moshe knew that God singled him out. Moshe knew that he went to the mountain. That never happened. Moshe knew that they'd never, that the Torah said that there'll never be another prophet like Moshe. Is that an ego thing or not? It's not. A truly humble person means a person that's living in accordance with the objective reality, with the objective truth. So if he knows medicine and someone gets sick, and so they ask, does anybody know? He'll say, yes, I know. He has to say that. He knows. That's not egotistical, because it's based upon truth. But where the person cultivates his own ego and he thinks that it's because of his own greatness, that's egotism. A humble person recognizes that he's very small in the scheme of things, that he has a certain sense of the vastness of the universe and the greatness of the Creator, compared to whom whatever he knows is nothing. So then he can't feel great. I have nothing great about me. Whatever I am is because God designed me in a certain way, and the true greatness is the Creator. So he doesn't worship the self. Now, the smaller the person, the more egotistical. That's a fundamental of Judaism. The greater the person, the more humble he is, because he realizes what's out there. The more you know, the more you see how little you know. Whatever, a true scientist like Einstein realizes that there's so much out there that he doesn't know, so what's he going to be? He's going to feel superior because of what he does know? But that means that he's comparing himself to others. He's living in the world of relative reality, of the social. That's the small person. That is a very, very small person. A big person is a humble person, because he has a sense of the greatness of the cosmos. And he realizes that he's, like David says, what is man that you remember him? Man is so small. But he fights evil. He fights evil. So the question remains as to why Moshe was not naive, and certainly after the first time when he employed pressure and Paro didn't keep his word, he shouldn't have trusted him anymore. Could have said it respectfully, that you start releasing the Jews and then I'll pull back the plague. Never says that. Always seems to be trusting. So therefore we must come to, well, this is my conclusion. We're taking up the question of why was Moshe such a quote-unquote bad negotiator. I don't mean to criticize Moshe, I'm just using those words to get everybody's attention. Any good negotiator, if you have something over the other person, all right, maybe one time you'll trust him, okay. The first time he trusts him, okay, maybe he gave him a chance. But then you see that the guy is a liar. And then the next time, this happens about 3 or 4 different times, when the blows are too powerful and Paro entreats Moshe, just remove this plague and I'll let them go. So Moshe should have said that after the first time, yeah, okay, start letting them go. No, this is my card, but I'm not going to give you my card. Why would he trust Paro anyways? The Jews have that weakness of being too trusting. They are. Take a look at the whole Oslo business and everything, and how terrible it is. And you study their history, you study their, but that's how they function. They break you down, and they don't intend to keep those agreements because they don't recognize your validity altogether. So whatever they're doing just to gain some ground, and then they're going to break the agreement. If you take a look at chapter 7, to answer this question, we have to have a little bit of a deeper understanding. What was the purpose of the plague? The purpose of the plagues was not simply to effectuate the release of the Jews. If that was the case, God doesn't need 10 plagues. God could have given them one good patch, so to speak, and they would have, or God could have removed them without any plagues. God could have put them all into some deep sleep and had the Jews leave, and then they would wake up and the Jews were gone. That wasn't the purpose of the 10 plagues. Not simply understood. If you take a look at chapter 7, this is pretty much at the outset. You know, Moshe experienced failures at the beginning too. As a result of his first meeting with Paro, Paro increased the workload and made them go out and get their own straw for the bricks and so forth, and thus diminishing Moshe in the eyes of the people. Okay, so then, but then God charges him on the mission, and says, "See, I have, this is in 7, I have made you like a god unto Paro." See, he had tremendous, Paro had tremendous respect for him. You see, he kept coming. Who, we mentioned that point, that who has the right to come before a mighty ruler? He could have killed him. And he goes up and back and so forth and speaks to him and warns him and so forth. Paro had tremendous respect for him. "Now Aaron, your brother, will be your prophet." So God worked out this arrangement where God would communicate with Moshe and Moshe would not speak to Paro. Aaron would be his spokesman. "You will speak everything that I command you, and Aaron, your brother, will speak to Paro that he should send out the Jews from Egypt." Now, verse 3 is one of the most difficult verses in the entire Torah, and we'll see to what extent we can make sense out of it. And then God says, "I will harden the heart of Paro, and I will increase my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt." Of course, that sounds very, very strange. What does that mean, that God will harden his heart? Does that mean that God will make him so stubborn that he won't listen? That seems to be difficult. Why would God harden his heart if the purpose is to convince him? So let's put that in brackets. "And Paro will not listen to you. And I will stretch my hand against Egypt. And I will take out my hosts." That's the reference to the Jews are the hosts. "My nation, the children of Israel from the land of Egypt, with great judgments." The next pasuk, in my opinion, contains the idea as to why Moshe Rabbeinu acted in the manner that he did, and hopefully will answer my question. That now, it wasn't that Moshe was not a good negotiator. That's not true. Because the next verse says, "V'yodu Mitzrayim ki ani Roshem." Egypt will know that I am God when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and when I take out the Bnei Yisrael, the children of Israel, from amongst them. That is to say, and this is a theme, this is a major theme that's repeated, that the purpose of God's interaction over here was not just to remove the Jews from the enslavement. The purpose was to reveal his existence to the entire world. And that Egypt should recognize. Egypt should recognize. And Egypt should know, because, as we say, God cares not only about the Jews, that God cares about the entire world. Indeed, that's the purpose of the Jewish people. That's the concept of being a light unto the nations, that God entrusted us with the Torah. But the purpose of the Jewish people is to keep the Torah, to elevate themselves, to be a special kind of people for themselves, but for all of mankind, a light unto the nations. You know, that's a very significant theme. It doesn't get enough attention. It's virtually, in this day and age, I mean, very few people pay attention to that point. It's very, very important, a principle. That's why when the Jews sinned with the golden calf and God said, "I'm going to destroy the nation," Moshe's major argument is, "What will Egypt say?" What does that mean? And Egypt here is representative of the nations of the world. That is, your plan was to take us out and to be our God, to set up a society so that all of mankind will know you. But if that happens, then the Egyptians will say that you failed, that you took us out in order to destroy us. They won't know the real reason that we sinned. They won't know that. So the whole plan will fall apart. Thus, that's a very significant thing, that God accepted that argument. That the Jews were saved not because of their own merit, but because of the fact that part of the purpose is that all of mankind should have a chance to know God.
But
the purpose of human history is for all of mankind to recognize God. Now, it's not a matter, did the Jews succeed in setting up the kind of society that was envisioned by the Torah? Have we succeeded? Well, there's been good times, bad times. I mean, the Jews existed in the land of Egypt. I'm sorry, in the land of Israel, built the temple. Then we sinned, and we were exiled, and we're still struggling. The purpose of the historical process is to fulfill the Torah, to fulfill it in a proper way. But all of mankind there's been progress. The primitive system of Egypt is not in effect anymore. They're primitive. They used to worship the sheep and so on and so forth. So the world itself has made some progress. But the fact, it doesn't mean, even if the Jews sin, God gave us the Torah so we'd live an elevated life. But there are times in history that the Jews descended and corrupted themselves and God punished them. That doesn't mean that God failed. That means that man has free will. That God will not coerce us. It's a very important thing to remember, that God will not coerce us into being good people. That he leaves to us. Everything is in the hands of heaven except the fear of heaven. So that's the fly in the ointment. That is a huge foundation, and it goes a long way. God does not interfere with man's free will. Well, except for that verse, which we just read, that I will harden the heart of Pharaoh. We'll see about that. So, because of this, God can give us the Torah, and God can bring the plagues, and it's intended for the Egyptians to learn and to use their minds and to improve themselves. Now, that's what I'm saying. That's why, I mean, Moshe was not a bad negotiator. Because the objective of the plagues, they are signs, they are wonders, is for people to think, to use their mind to understand and to arrive at a decision that this is the truth, but not to be coerced into it. Moshe Rabbeinu did not want to twist their arm to the point that they would be forced to let the Jews go, because that would be of no value whatsoever. It would not be a moral decision. A moral decision, a person only benefits when he arrives at something as a result of his reflection, his understanding, his knowledge, and his free will. A foxhole conversion is not really of much value. That the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu relented and removed it and gave them time to fulfill their, was because if it's a foxhole phenomenon, like there's no atheist in the foxhole. So many people, when they're suffering, they'll make a deal with God, whether they have an illness, and they'll experience something which they regard as a miracle, the miraculously saved. But does that necessarily mean that they're going to change their lives? My sense is that most of the people that have those kinds of moments, Hemingway wrote a very interesting, beautiful, very short story about depicting this person in the foxhole. And, bombs are coming in, this and that, and he's pleading with God, and he's making all kinds of promises, and he's saved. And he sort of ends it like a few nights later, he was in the bar, and he's drinking, and he never spoke about God again, something to that effect. The overwhelming majority of people that go through those kinds of experiences, and they're convinced. They're convinced at the moment that they're going to change their whole life. You turn to God, you believe in God, and you're praying for something. Maybe it's like impossible, but then it happens. So of course, then there must be a God in the world. There's a God in the world. When things work out, then there's a God. When it happens to somebody else, yeah. But when it happens for you, then there's a God in the world. My sense of it is, and my experience is, that very rarely does this produce any kind of a change. And it's a sincere emotion. The person at that moment is jumping for joy and he's thanking God. And he remembers. It's kind of like we just had it this past week. What in this past week's parsha, is there anything akin to that that reminds you of this phenomenon? What about that guy in the prison with Joseph, the one who had the dream? Right, the two of them, the butler and the baker. And Joseph uses his powers of dream and interpretation, and he figured it out. And one of them, in 3 days, one of them got good news. In fact, the other guy who was guilty, he waited. He saw the other guy got good news. Maybe I got good news. So then he told him the story. No, you're bad news. 3 days, he's going to... You can see from the dream itself that that he was bringing the bread, that he had a lot of animosity against Paro, and the birds were taking the bread. Whereas in the dream of the butler, you saw how he loved what he was doing, and he was squeezing the bread. There was a lot, you could learn a lot just from the dream itself. So Yosef pleads with him to put in a good word for me, and that I was stolen from the land of the Hebrews, and I didn't do anything over here. That's questionable whether he should have said these things. That's a very a fascinating story. Maybe he did. Maybe that wasn't the way to go about it. You know? It sounds on the surface, yeah, like he's got this opportunity. He did this. Remember me. In 3 days you're going to be removed from here, and you're going to be exonerated, and you're going to be restored to your position, and you're going to be the chief butler of Paro. So please remember me to Paro. Put in a good word for me. That's all he asked. Just too much. Just too much to ask. Is that right? No, a good deed. There was a good deed. He pleaded with him, just remember me. And you would have thought, I'm sure he said, of course. The Torah doesn't record it. But if he said, no, I'm not going to do it, the Torah would have recorded it. Because why does it have to tell you afterwards, Lo Zachar Sarah Mashkim as Paro, that the Sarah Mashkim did not remember Yosef. Lo Zachar as Yosef. He didn't remember. Vayishkecheu. First, he didn't remember. They didn't forget him. But let me enjoy it. Let me, you know, it's too soon. I don't want to, like, bring up bad stuff. I want to, nah, forget about it. What do I have to... I'm only suggesting that maybe Yosef, by presenting it that way, that he was stolen, he was kidnapped, and here maybe he made it more difficult, because maybe part of his idea was, well, who knows about this guy, what his troubles are, what his story is, what do I have to... He didn't, he forgot, except he remembered 2 years later when he had the dreams, and then when it was in his own interests. You see how selfish people are? It's amazing how selfish people are. What would it have taken to just put in a word about this poor kid and the who's a brilliant guy? He can interpret dreams. Power can always use another dream interpreter. But he didn't do it. He did not do it because he only cared about one thing, himself. And I guarantee you that at the time, he would have guaranteed Yosef that he would do it. Of course. Why not? I mean, you've made me feel so good. He was desperate. The dream was killing him. That's the way people are. So that the foxhole conversion, anything which a person does under the pain, under the duress, is really of no meaning. It's just a powerful feeling. And the person fools himself, because he thinks that because I feel so powerfully about it, I'm definitely going to do something about it. No, doesn't mean a thing. It'll wear off. Your own underlying nature will win out. Because if your real nature is to live a certain way, that's what you're going to do. And you have moments of emotional gratitude. You feel like you'll do anything for the person. That feeling is going to wear off. Every feeling will wear off. Except if you make up your mind to implement it, to start making changes, like in any area. You know, you see a thing on TV about nutrition, well, and a healthy life, and you have this feeling, there's no question in my mind, I'm going to start exercising, I'm going to start this. Yeah, okay, I feel it, but you feel so good about yourself that you take a little nap and tomorrow, because it's windy outside.
Exactly.
The only way that a person makes changes is not because of the power of the feeling, it's the habit. We're creatures of habit, and if you determine you will make something a habit, if nutrition is good, then you will make it a habit, and you'll have to fight your nature for a few weeks. It'll be difficult. You'll want this, you'll want that. But as time goes by, it'll become part of your nature. The same is true with exercise. The same is true with Torah study. A person must be a creature of discipline. And the most powerful feeling in the world is meaningless. You can... gratitude, whatever it is, all these things. If those are not your habits, if you haven't implemented that, then it's not going to make a difference. That's why what Moshe wanted, at least, that they would make this decision not under duress. Because, all right, they saw the event. That's what happened. The plagues were not of the kind that they, except for the last one, the killing of the firstborn. That was not a free will decision. They had no choice. They failed the test. God gave them opportunities time after time after time. to make the choice, that they had seen enough. They had seen enough to know that there's something going on over here. They should take it to heart. It was Paro that was stubborn. And many of the Egyptians did. You see, the whole attitude towards the Jews changed. And when the time came, they had a great esteem for the Jews. And they gave them gifts to go. The attitude of the Egyptians had changed. But that's my explanation, that Moshe was not a bad negotiator. If the only purpose was to coerce them, then he would have said, all right, you let them go, and then I'll remove the plague. But that was not the purpose. There's a bigger purpose over here. The bigger purpose is that the compassion, you see the compassion, that even though the Jews were being subjugated, and it would have been great to get them out quicker, but the bigger purpose was, if everybody, the whole world can be perfected if people recognize the truth. People recognize the creator of the universe and they give up idolatry and they act in a moral way, a way which finds favor with the creator, then that's the way to go. That's good for the world. He acted in a manner, and no one appreciates this, he did not act in a manner like the average leader would just be concerned with his own people and that's it. And the heck with the Egyptians, whoever, who cares? Whatever you suffer, you deserve. Which is true, they did deserve it. But that was not his purpose. His purpose was not to wreak havoc, or even revenge. You don't see an element of revenge over here. In terms of succeeding, that's a good question. That's a good question. That's a hard question. The Torah does not really provide us with the kind of, you know, that kind of detail and information. I would say that in a certain sense he did succeed, in a certain sense he didn't. But I want to show you from the text. Show me from the text of the story. In chapter 9, verse 17. This is the meeting that Moshe has with Paro before one of the most powerful. You know, the Makos, the plagues keep getting more powerful, more devastating. This is before the one of hail. So again, there's always the way. See, again, it was preceded by a warning to give them the opportunity to contemplate, to think it over. And he says that you're still controlling my people and refusing to let them go. So this time tomorrow, I'm going to rain down a very heavy hail. Now this is an important, the like of which has never been seen in Egypt. So it's not just the force, the power, but also the fact that it's different, that it's unique, that's never happened before. Again, to waken up your mind that there's something unusual going on over here. This is not the ordinary course of nature. When they resisted, they were, see, God works in a way, he gives you room to resist. You could say, well, we're experiencing a new type of a weather pattern that we've never experienced before. But that's all part of nature. God always gives man room to resist and to deny. That's vital. That's crucial. God is not going to impose himself on you in a way which there's no room. Because then you're not man, human. That's not human. Then there's no free will. If God wanted to make us all righteous, so then he'd take away our free will. We'd all be robots. Righteous robots. But the dilemma of man is that God gives us free will. And if he gives us free will, there's room to deny. There's room for you to manifest your willfulness, your stubbornness. We have room for that. God does not stop you from doing that. Rishus nasuna. God knows everything, but freedom is given. God has given you freedom. And he's not going to come and strike you down if you go out and eat ham. He doesn't work that way. People have that feeling. I know a lot of people. The first time that they ate treif, they thought God. When it didn't happen, they all right. So they, but that's not the point. God does not. The whole Torah is not for God at all. It's for our benefit. He's giving us a system to live by, to have discipline, to have control, and so on and so forth. Then he so look at the kindness. So he says, now tell your people to gather in your livestock and all that you have in the field. Any man or beast that shall be found in the field and not be taken into the house, the hail shall fall on them and they shall die. Now you see again, this is so Moshe had no desire to hurt them. He's warning them that this is what's going to happen. So spread the word and let the people know and bring in They shouldn't be out there in the field and get their animals in. So what does the Pasuk say in the next? Those who feared the word of God from the servants of Pharaoh, they brought in their servants and they brought in their animals from the field. So what do you see? That there were those who feared God. That was the achievement. Was it all of the people? No. But it's not measured. We can't measure in terms of numbers. How many people is it important that should recognize God in this world and it has significance? Well, even one person perhaps. Because we read in the story of the flood that all of mankind had achieved a certain degree of corruption and Noah found favor. Noah found favor, one person. People don't pay enough attention to that story. People don't take it seriously. But were it not for Noah who found favor, and all of mankind would revert to a state of utter animalistic, instinctualistic existence, then the world would have been destroyed. Questions being raised as to why Moshe didn't speak directly to Pharaoh. Yeah, he could have, but as we said, that's a miraculous phenomenon. I would just speculate a little bit that first of all, it did increase the stature of Moshe as a prophet, that he communicated with God, and then Aaron would speak. That sort of gives a person a certain stature. But I would also think that Moshe Rabbeinu had some kind of a speech impediment, as we know. We don't know exactly whether he stuttered, whatever. Then, because of that, there would be room, it seems to me. The objective over here was to give the Egyptians an opportunity. God, as we said, cares about the nations, all of his creations. And it's not that he cares about the Jews more, that's not the case. But he wanted to give them every opportunity to change and to recognize him and to give up their false way. Now, had Moshe been the spokesman, again, this is my opinion, had Moshe been the spokesman, they would have had room to complain and said that he wasn't communicating well with us. Had you given us a good communicator, then we would have listened. He did not want to leave any room for the nations to be able to complain and say that you didn't communicate properly with us. Now, Aaron was a good communicator. So thus, you had both. You had the greatest prophet was there, so you could trust that the message was coming from God. And the spokesman was smooth and was able to communicate. In conclusion, then, the purpose of the 10 plagues was not simply to have the Jews removed, but to have them removed in a certain manner. That is, as a result of the fact that everybody would recognize the Creator and acknowledge God, and that the Jews were his people. So then that would be a tremendous benefit for Egypt itself. Indeed, that was the idea, and that is still the idea. The ultimate purpose of history, of not just Jewish history, but of world history, has not been achieved. That's our goal today. That's our purpose. We should be cognizant of that. If that's the case, if we go back to chapter 7, verse 3, what does it mean, I will harden the heart of Pharaoh? And I will increase my wonders and signs. It seems from this that Pharaoh is actually being held back. That is, God is hardening his heart, making him stubborn, that otherwise he might be amenable to reason. So there's a major argument over here, and we can't take it up in full, between two great Jewish thinkers. You have the Rambam on the one hand, and I'll leave the Rambam. The Rambam has a special doctrine about free will, that there are certain situations in which God will take away a person's free will. That doctrine of the Rambam is elucidated in the laws of Tshuva. If you're familiar with the works of the Rambam, the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam elucidates the doctrine that under certain circumstances a person no longer deserves to have free will and God will take it away from him. That's basically how the Rambam learns what Paro. There are certain distinct evil personalities who are given every opportunity, but it reaches a certain stage of evil where God will decide to take away his free will. However, that's not the view of the other commentator that I'm referring to is called the Sforno. He learns it differently, has a very ingenious interpretation. And he says that the hardening of the heart over here is in reference that the blows are going to get stronger and stronger progressively. The first one was relatively minor, the blood and the water, whatever. But they're going to get stronger and stronger, and much more painful. And he says that to the contrary, God never takes away a person's free will. That God, always, we read about this on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that God waits for the wicked person. Always, God is long-suffering and God waits. And God gives up many, many opportunities. It's not so simple. You can't say, well, why is this person a bad, wicked person and he's still alive and he's still... Because God is patient, so to speak. And gives him a chance. So God does not take that away. If that's the case, what does it mean to harden the heart? It means to give him a certain emotional fortitude. Because we said, if a person is so scared by an event that he's forced to give in, then that's not free choice. So God is saying that I'm going to bring these powerful plagues on Egypt. And ordinarily, people in their ordinary state are going to be so intimidated and frightened, they'll just give in. So God will intervene and strengthen them and make them harder and stronger. Because you wonder, that Paro was a strong guy. In spite of everything he went through, he still didn't give in. He gave in momentarily, but then he would bounce back. He was not intimidated. And that's what the Sforno learns. That he's not going to be, in spite of all of the powerful plagues that are going to rain down, I'm not going to allow him to become weak. I'm going to maintain a certain balance within him. In order for you to have free will, you have to have a certain balance between two forces within you. And that is, you have to have a certain humbleness, you have to have a certain ability to be affected. On the other hand, if you don't have a certain strength, you have to have a certain strength that you can sort of resist it and think it over and make your own decision. You see, if either side becomes too extreme, then there's not going to be any free will. If you're too independent and stubborn and you can't be affected by anything, if God made us so strong, then we'd never be able to change. We'd never be able to acknowledge anything higher than ourselves. There's got to be a certain weakness in the person that we do have a certain weakness, because we have weaknesses, because we have illnesses. It causes us to think we're not supreme beings. If a person was always strong and always successful and he never had a moment of weakness or a setback, so he'd never acknowledge God. From the emotional standpoint. On the other hand, if a person is so weak and so frightened that he doesn't have any backbone, so then he'll give in. He'll give in, but that won't be free will. So there's got to be, only God knows that balance between the two sides. And what's going to happen, God is saying, is what's going to happen to him now will take away his free will. Because the blows are going to be too painful. So I will strengthen him. I will harden his heart. To give him the capability of resisting, that is to say, he will not be broken from the emotional standpoint. But that'll give him the opportunity to think, to use his mind. And if he uses his mind, he still has free will. It's the exact opposite, the diametric opposite of the Rambam. Both Pshatim are very, very beautiful. But that's what he learns. Because ultimately, that's the objective. The objective of... And it's interesting, there was a moment when he didn't have free will. And that was the night of the killing of the firstborn. And according to the rabbis, he himself had, his own firstborn were killed, and the screams, that's what, a night of terror. It was to create a certain type of, that's why it was right midnight, in the middle of the night. And a terror and scream, there was not one house where there was not a dead. And that's when he sent for Moshe in the middle of the night. But that wasn't free will. That was simply because that God did not give him the strength to be able to resist, and it was just a natural response. Proof of that is, in spite of everything that they had seen and gone through, it's a lesson for us. And then the next day the Jews left with a mighty hand, and the Egyptians were burying their dead. They were burying their dead, and then a few days later he says, "Why are we crazy? Why did we leave them? Why did we allow them to go? Why did we leave them from serving us? Well, they didn't come back." And he gathers together a whole army and they go running to their doom. It's an amazing kind of a thing. It should be a lesson for all of us to utilize that the greatest gift that God has given us is the capacity to make decisions, to not be enslaved by our own nature, to overcome our nature, to fight against our nature, and to make the proper utilization of our free will. Therein lies the entire purpose of the Torah. Therein lies the course of perfection.